Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday, Wednesday edition. We want to start off with a quick apology and a bit of information to give to you. Normally, we will record the shows on Tuesday and have them released later that day. In my world, everything was rolling along just fine and was filming on the Holzer Files Monday. When late Monday evening, we were contacted via our production company and Travel Channel that everybody was being put on hiatus. It was going to be shut down for a little bit till everything passes. It's just too unstable out there, and they did not want to end up stranding us in the faraway state of Maine. So we were all sent home yesterday morning during the time I would normally be recording the show. So we didn't have a chance to connect with our guest. Thankfully, he was kind enough to move the date and time to record with us here on Wednesday. So we're releasing the show just a day late, but not a dollar short. We're still here giving you your money's worth. I also wanted to just say, if you could all keep Tim and his family in your prayers, they're going through some health crisis with his mother and father. And this is an unknown and scary enough time right now. To have two parents in and out of hospitals is adding a lot of undue stress and pressure on his entire family, his mom and dad mostly, and then all of the kids and family members, of course. So if you could keep them in your prayers and thoughts for a full and healthy recovery and that no one ends up exposed to this virus while visiting them and spending time taking them to the hospital, specifically our pal Tim, who, again, with his diabetes and such, has a compromised immune system. And he has had to spend a few days and nights in the hospital with his mother and father. And we just pray that everybody is taken care of and safe. All right, let's get started, shall we? We've got a special going on this week, a two-for-one on Troy Taylor, folks. Troy Taylor, our guest today for True Crime Tuesday, will be joining us a little bit later on this week. He'll be with us on our Sunday show for Beyond the Darkness. We're going to talk about his book, A Song of Dance and Death, Magic, Murder, Mayhem, and the Diabolical Notes of the Devil's Music. That's this weekend's Beyond the Darkness, Darkness radio show. So make sure that you tune in for that. We'll have Supernatural News, Parashare on Saturday as normal. Troy will be back with us Sunday. Today, we are here to talk about a new volume in his book series, Without a Trace, Unsolved Disappearances and Mysterious Vanishings. Troy Taylor has been a longtime friend of our show, has been with us, I think, since season one of Darkness Radio. He is a supernatural historian, a murder buff, and the author of around 90 books on ghosts, hauntings, history, crime, and the unexplained in America. He is also the founder of the American Hauntings Ghost Tour Company. Troy, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being
here.
Hey,
well, I'm glad to be here. I think that me being here twice in one week just implies I have nowhere to go.
Right. You know, but that's just how bad this virus is. Right. That's one of the few upsides of this virus is we're able to actually get Troy Taylor when he's got a little downtime. So I took advantage of that weakness, and we are here together. I wanted to, you know, I mean, you've been doing different books in this Dead Men Do Tell Tales series and true crime. I'm just curious, you know, as somebody who obviously is interested in the supernatural and true crime myself, what was the kind of bridging of that chasm between those two genres that you find so fascinating?
Well, really the series was put together in the first place just because it seemed like with every historical or even sometimes more current murder that I would be delving into or series of murders or whatever, there always seemed to be ghost stories attached in some way. And, you know, it such a frequent thing. I mean, when we look back and think about, you know, ghost stories and supernatural events, I mean, we always say, oh, you know, ghosts are here because of some sort of unfinished business or because they met a sudden end and don't realize they're dead. And, you know, pretty much all of these reasons that we have for hauntings connect to crimes. You know, if someone's murdered, suddenly their spirit remains behind. They don't know they're dead, or they left with some sort of unfinished business because their killer was never found. And so putting those two things together has been really of interest to me because I'm a buff of both fields. I mean, I love the supernatural and I love to research and write about true crime. So putting those together just kind of seemed like a natural to me. And it also gives me excuse sometimes to put out some books in that series that aren't necessarily ghost related, but are certainly weird, which is how I ended up with Without a Trace. It's not, I mean, there are some of the stories in here that seem to be sort of unexplainable. I mean, you guys should call them supernatural. But for the most part, most of them are just unsolved and sometimes so bizarre that you almost can't explain them in any other way other than to say that the supernatural is involved.
I have a story I wanted to ask you about, and you are a font of knowledge, especially where it comes to the Illinois area. And that's where I grew up, was in the Chicago suburbs. And I remember reading a really weird case. I want to say it was probably in the 1980s. And I've Googled, I don't know if this is a weird form of the Mandela effect or what, but I remember this story, and I'll put it out for you. If you don't recall what I'm talking about, then perhaps one of our listeners can reach out and try to find these stories. But there was a really weird story of this disappearance of this little girl. And she went missing. They had called in psychics. Psychics were connecting, and she had passed away. They were trying to find this body. People were witnessing her ghost appearing to them as though beckoning, calling them towards wherever she may be. Years later, they ended up finding this little girl alive. And they talk about this in the article. And they said, but so many people were witnessing this ghost, and mediums were so connected to the fact that she was she had passed. Now, obviously, it's easy enough as a skeptic to dismiss the claims of mediums. Sylvia Brown certainly did herself no justice in some public displays. I think she was on Montel once when she told this woman, well, your daughter's dead, you're just going to have to get used to it, and blah, blah, blah. She was very callous about it, and the daughter ended up being alive. They found her years later. So there's these moments when, you know, the mediums are not always on. I don't believe that makes all of them frauds or charlatans. But when you have such a large grouping of mediums coming forward saying this little girl's dead and people seeing her spirit, and then she suddenly appears, but I cannot for the life of me. And I would think with those trigger words, I would have found an article.
Yeah.
Remember that taking place? I can't remember if the original disappearance, I think, took place in the late 70s. The reappearance came back in the 80s, and that's when this article came out. Does this ring a bell for you in Illinois at all?
No. That doesn't ring a bell. But, I mean, I'll look into it, too. Maybe I can dig something up. But interestingly, you know, the idea when you were telling me the story, I'm not familiar with the case, but I am familiar with the idea of apparitions of the living. I'm sure you are, too. Crisis apparitions that appear to people sometimes. And, you know, nobody knows for sure. I mean, we really don't know how any of this stuff really works. But in this case, we don't know why it happens sometimes. But there have been a lot of recorded instances of people's who are still alive of their ghosts appearing. That was one of the very first big publications that the Society of Psychical Research put out in the late 19th century. It was a book called Phantasms of the Living. And these were, you know, people who are in these horrific crisis type situations where they sort of psychically send out their image, their own apparition to people who they're connected to in some way, who then pick up on these stories and believe that they're, you know, believe they're seeing a ghost. I mean, that's what that sounds like. But like I said, I'm not really familiar with the story, but it does sound like that.
Well, and it makes you wonder, right? I mean, if they are seeing the spirit of this little girl, is she in a way astral projecting at night? I mean, her only escape at that point in her life is the dream realm. And it makes you wonder just how thin that veil between death and dreams really is. You know, are we traversing the world of the dead? And maybe why we see so many people in dreams we don't know and have never come into contact with is because that's the death that we're traversing in.
Yeah, I had a theory about that at one time. And I had a dream that had a friend of mine in it. And so I got a hold of her and I said, hey, is there any chance? I mean, here's a weird conversation. Hey, any chance that you dreamed about me last night? She's like, no. And I'm like, okay, that's not what it sounded like. Here's the reason I'm explaining that. But yeah, so it didn't work. But I kept thinking, you know, if all these people we see in our dreams that we don't know, are they dreaming about us as someone they don't know? And we're like hanging out in our dreams. But I don't know. My theory apparently didn't hold a lot of water, as it turned out. So,
or just she was just an awkward conversation. Yeah, perhaps she was just too embarrassed to admit it. But that's a hell of a pickup line, because when you can connect with that person.
Well, it wasn't meant to be one. It was completely innocent, but still.
Understandable. What in all of the stories that you've examined over the years, the strange true crimes and mysterious disappearances, I'm just curious, which ones with like a bizarre kind of supernatural slant really kind of jump out at you?
Well, I've got lots. I mean, you hate to say you've got favorite disappearances. It's kind of like saying, this is my favorite serial killer or something. But, you know, the weirdest one that I swear that I mean, and there are others, and some of them are just a nutshell story. But this one was interesting because there was it started in Kankakee, Illinois, you know, just south of Chicago. And it was in June of 1968. And there was this husband and wife, Gerald Potter and his wife, Carrie, and they were going to Vegas for I think they're going to Texas for a Lions Club convention. And they got on a private DC-3 jet, took off from Kankakee, and were flying to Texas, and were somewhere over the Ozarks when Gerald told his wife that he needed to use the restroom. So he went to the back of the plane and went into the bathroom, and, you know, everything seemed normal. I guess he talked to some of his friends on his way back. And she said that a few minutes passed, and then all of a sudden the plane just sort of like, I don't know, jolted, like there was a, you know, little air turbulence or something, and which bothered her. And because she didn't like to fly, started looking around for her husband, and he still hadn't come back to the seat. So she told the flight attendant that he was in the restroom and could somebody check and see if he's okay, because he'd been in there a long time. And so they went back. The door to the restroom was locked. They got it open, but he wasn't in it. And the door of the plane had not been opened. I mean, obviously an alarm would have gone off even in the late 60s. If the door to the plane had been opened, everyone would have noticed the wind sucking through there. They searched the entire plane, searched everywhere, the luggage compartments, the whole thing. And when they finally landed, they had an emergency landing in Springfield, Missouri, because this guy had disappeared. And somehow he left this plane without ever opening any doors or windows or anything. He just completely vanished. And it's never been solved. They sued the airline. The case was thrown out because they couldn't prove the airline had done anything wrong. The safety bar was still in place over the door. Just nothing. I mean, this guy just disappeared. And for whatever reason, that particular story has just really stuck with me, because it's impossible. I mean, it's an impossible situation, and yet it happened. And so that was one that I just found to be so weird. And I don't even know if I would call it supernatural as much as I would call it, I don't even know what I'd call it. Paranormal, maybe. But it's just baffling. I mean, it's one thing when somebody like Jimmy Hoffa disappears or something, you think, okay, well, the mob got him somehow. We just don't know what happened or who got him, you know, or, you know, public figures or people who disappeared into the jungle or something there. That's interesting. And it's always kind of cool because it's an unsolved mystery, but you can get a pretty good idea of what happened to people like that. But not in this case. I mean, this guy just literally just disappeared, and there's no way to explain it. Just none. Absolutely none.
Now, so, I mean,
it's always bothered me.
Yeah, I would understand. And as we look through that now through the lens of 2020 vision, right, and go back to this crime or this strange disappearance, has there been any interesting scenarios developed that they think may explain what happened?
No. Nobody really talks about this story much anymore, but no one ever came up with a theory. There just isn't one. I mean, even when it happened, I mean, they tried to sue the airline and say that it had something to do with, you know, it was their fault because, you know, he had, you know, gotten out of the plane somehow and that they were at fault, but no one could ever prove it. I mean, there was nothing to prove. I mean, lawyers, you know, all kinds of lawyers. There were 22 passengers on board, 2 flight attendants, but nobody saw anything. And the door to the plane never opened. So, I mean, because the DC-3 doesn't fly or didn't fly that high at the time, you know, the plane wasn't pressurized. So, I mean, if he'd opened the door, people would have heard it, but it wouldn't be like someone would get sucked out. So let's say he thought it was the bathroom, although the bathroom door was locked from the inside. But let's say he would not have fit down the toilet hole. But let's say he did accidentally open the door, which is what, you know, people tried to suggest had happened. He would have had to have moved, like, you know, two different locks just to get the door open, which was difficult to open under normal circumstances. But even if it had opened, everyone would have heard that door open and an alarm would have gone off in the cockpit and in the, you know, in the main cabin of the plane. But yet nothing did. Nothing happened. Eventually, they searched all around the Ozark area where the plane was flying. But I mean, you know, looking for a body. But they, you know, I mean, that could have easily have gotten lost. But no one ever found anything. And the exit door didn't open and they couldn't come up with a reason or an explanation for what happened. None.
What now, in your estimation, you know, we're going to vacillate between true crime, mysterious disappearances and high woo factor here. But you've got a plane in the sky. The plane hits this weird little pocket of turbulence. A man goes vanished. Is there any chance that this falls into the realm of a UFO encounter, do you think?
Maybe. I mean, nobody reported one, but it does. I mean, it sounds like something like that, really. I mean, if you want to start speculating and use your imagination, you could say that, you know, a UFO flew by and beamed this one particular guy out of the bathroom of the plane and into the UFO and off they went. I mean, if you just want to get crazy, you know, with speculations. I mean, or you could say that when this plane hit some sort of turbulence, that wasn't what it was. Let's say it was some kind of interdimensional kind of thing where this one particular guy, for some reason, not the entire plane, just one man who was separated from everyone else, slipped into another dimension. Let's say this guy did fall to his death, but not in our world, but in another one. You know what I mean? So, I mean, there's a lot of weird ways that you could go with this. And the problem is that we say weird ways, or we say, you know, the woo factor, or, you know, let's get crazy and say this. But on the other hand, what's the logical explanation here? What's the reasonable one? Well, there isn't one. That's the thing. So you really can pretty much put anything you want to on this one. You know, it's like the Mary Celeste. You know, I mean, here's the most famous ghost ship in history. You know, people found this ship, you know, sitting empty on the ocean. The entire crew is gone. There's only a handful of clues behind. You know, did they leave on their own? Did they disappear? And there's been so many, again, all the speculation, you know, that the alcohol that was in the hold released fumes and they had to flee the ship. But left no sign. Did they, you know, was there I've heard water spouts, you know, came along and sucked everybody off the ship, but of course it did no damage. I've heard stories about the Kraken, you know, I mean, UFOs, you name it, because this kind of thing, from a disappearance to an airplane to and the entire crew of a ship. And I've got a lot of them in this book. A lot of people went missing from ships over the years, but where do you stop? Where do you draw the line in your explanations? Do you say, you know, oh, a water spout's credible, but a sea monster isn't? Well, I mean, sure. I mean, I guess
if that water spout reaches up as a giant hand and grasps each individual person off the deck of that ship and from inside the hull.
Right. Yeah. But there would be people who would say that that's logical, but a sea monster or a UFO is not. And that's just as illogical as the sea monster or the UFO in almost all these cases. I think that's what makes it so fascinating, is because we can speculate all we want. And, you know, there's a lot of crime victims who, or we assume they were crime victims, who disappeared in this book, too. You know, a young woman goes out running one day and who on a course that she runs constantly and disappears, you know.
Hold on one second. If I could ask you, just talking about with the ship, how long had it been out there missing before it was found completely emptied of every living soul?
That's the thing. We there's no way we can know for sure, because you know, it's not like anybody was radioing in or anything. You know, it was I mean, that made it a mystery, because, you know, they assumed it was a couple of weeks based on, you know, the logs that they had, but then again, that's all they had to go by. So they couldn't be sure, because somebody had seen it, you know, a short time before. I believe it was just just a couple of weeks before was the last time it had been seen by another ship. And then the next thing you know, they're finding it adrift. And during that time, apparently in the 7 or 8 days, everyone on board disappeared. And like I said, there were some signs left. I mean, you know, one of the lifeboats was gone. But so it looked like they had left in a hurry. They'd taken the compass, I believe, but didn't take any of the logbooks, which was odd. You'd have to really be in a hurry not to do something like that, because those were essential, because we didn't have radios and things back then at the time. And, you know, there was, you know, breakfast food still sitting on the table and that kind of thing, which, you know, made it spookier, but still didn't point any direction as to what had happened. You know, the ship was filled with alcohol, but it wasn't alcohol you could drink. So, you know, it wasn't like everyone got drunk and then decided to mutiny or something. They did find, I believe, one of the crates that had been broken open, which either suggested that, you know, to some people, that the fumes from the alcohol may have caused either A, the crew to go crazy and decide to mutiny, or, you know, the fumes were so bad they had to abandon the ship, which seems unlikely. It's also suggested that there may have been piracy or smugglers involved, or someone who'd gotten aboard the ship and tried to take it and then broke open the cask and discovered that it wasn't alcohol, that was drinking alcohol. And then, you know, decided to kill the entire, you know, crew and captain and his wife and throw them overboard. But again, we don't know. We'll probably never know, which is where we get into speculation about, you know, UFOs and sea serpents. So
it's strange, but like in the piracy that would take place at those times, you know, I've been doing a lot more reading on that and hearing what they would do. They would come in and completely loot and murder most of the people.
Sure.
And just leave the bodies there. There was no cause to clear them or hide any crimes.
Well, and right. But, and this was also 1872. So there really weren't any pirates around by that time. And not the kind that had been preying on ships, you know, since the 16 and 1700s. By 1872, we're well past the Civil War, and it was not, you know, pirates were not a common thing that you would encounter at sea, especially, you know, I mean, just, I don't know, the North Atlantic, there just weren't a lot of pirates around that area. So when they came aboard and they found, you know, things that were undisturbed, I mean, it didn't look like there had been any kind of attack or anything like that. I mean, you know, when you walk into the captain's quarters and the food's still on the table and, you know, and next to a plate's an open bottle of cough medicine with a cork sitting next to it, you got to think not much has been disturbed in the ship, you know, but everyone was gone. They took off and abandoned the place. So what could have happened? I mean, I don't know. It's still baffling. I mean, that's why it's still one of the great mysteries. And, you know, there's been, again, lots of speculation, you know, where storms and, I mean, just all kinds of stuff. But we just don't know. And I think that's what makes it so fascinating. I mean, everybody loves a mystery. You know, I mean, that's why there's a whole industry created around, you know, mystery fiction. But sometimes this stuff is a lot more mysterious, because when you're talking about real life, you don't have to offer an explanation. You know, the detective isn't going to come in at the last chapter and solve everything. No one is. We're probably never going to know the answers to any of the questions that are raised in this book or in any of these unsolved mysteries. It's chances are we'll never know. Not for sure, anyway.
You know, over the years of having done so many episodes on true crime, two stories really kind of jumped out at me. You know, we were talking earlier about the ghosts and making themselves known. There was a case, and you and I from the Illinois area, I remember growing up and hearing this as it was breaking, the story of John Wayne Gacy.
Oh, sure.
And yeah. It was a really chilling story that had come up that one of the, you know, he would be doing things and he had all these young boys that worked for him. And at one point he had sent one of the kids home to his house to go feed his dogs or do some menial task. And while Gacy was working or at the bar or something, and the kid got to the back door and he heard what he believed to be many screams coming from inside this house. Now, we know that at that point everybody was dead.
Mm-hmm.
But this kid's blood ran cold. He stopped and left. And we don't know, you know, had he gone in, what might have happened to him?
Yeah.
How soon would Gacy have arrived afterwards? But this kid just kind of took off. And then, you know, we've done a couple episodes, of course, on Ted Bundy. Mm-hmm. And what stood out with me, you know, on one of the interviews, we talked to the guy and he was very straight laced on the angle of true crime. And I said, you know, this guy just sounds off from childhood with some of the things that he was doing, you know. And when he was like 5 years old, he's got a knife and he's sliding it underneath the sheet as he's looking at his aunt's body. And I said, this just sounds like, you know, and I'm not trying to make an excuse, you know, the devil made me do it stuff.
Sure.
But this sounds like, if you were to believe in reincarnation, this sure sounds like an old soul or something inside a child that at age five, there's already this strange sexual predilection and violence factor built into him. Because I've known a lot of 5 year olds, you know, my 11 kids and growing up as a 5 year old at one point, that never connected in my brain, sexuality or violence like that, you know, maybe playing cops and robbers, cowboys and Indians. Yeah. I mean, there's that basic violent nature of all boys picking up a stick and turning it into a gun. But this was something far beyond. And he actually talked about the fact that during the case, one of the things that he did not include in the book was the fact that as Bundy was on trial and one of the bodies was found, they said his attorneys said that his eyes changed color and that he began emitting this foul sulfur smell.
Really? And I hadn't heard that. Wow.
Right. How bizarre. And then I thought, okay, again, maybe this guy just got a weird story. But if, you know, the Bundy tapes came out, that documentary a few years ago.
Yeah.
And in the opening of it, one of them says, you know, Ted had the clearest blue eyes, but at times they would turn completely black. And that's on their record as well.
Well,
so
yeah,
to me, it's interesting. Bizarre. You don't want to just dismiss and make it a supernatural event.
Right.
But this guy, the ability, the uncanny ability to come and go for many years and get away with heinous crimes and escape repeatedly. And it almost feels like if you want to believe that the devil is out there, and the devil made me do it, this guy's case seems to stand out to me even more.
Yeah,
because
more so than anybody else that I've ever run across. Yeah, I agree with you. Much more than, say, Ramirez, who was putting on a big show, you know, being the devil, all this stuff. But yeah, Bundy does seem like if there's anybody, yeah, it was him.
Well, and he was never claiming possession or any influence and never claimed to be into the supernatural. You know, Ramirez, it seems like, was painting a pretty good insanity plea story for himself.
Right.
But you start examining those aspects of crime and it's just, you know, you start looking at some of the weirder aspects that just make no sense. Like you said, the disappearance from a full plane, an entire that, you know, the cough medicine is uncorked, the breakfast food is still on the table, and there's not a soul to be found and nothing really out of place. It really sets you on edge with the way some of these crimes, and I don't know if you even call that a crime when it comes to the Mary Celeste, but if there was some kind of piracy, whether it was just in human form taking those the sailors off and putting them into slavery in some form. You know, it could very well be. Well, what are some of the other more unusual stories that stand out to you? And again, the book, folks, Without a Trace, Unsolved Disappearances and Mysterious Vanishings. We have a link to Troy's website and to this specific book on today's program, so you can find it very easily. But I again, recommend, as I always do, pick up the book. We're going to gloss over some of these stories. We're not going to get into depth.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot more that we couldn't get to. Yeah, for sure.
So go check it out. And remember, rate and review the books, too, folks. Always rate and review these books to help our guests get a higher profile on Amazon and other booksellers.
Well, I wanted to mention one that is another one just completely without a trace, and it's weird, and I'm going to say that most people outside of the where I'm sitting right now don't know this story except from when I put it in this book. But in 1915, I live in Jacksonville, Illinois. I guess I should mention that. That's where our company is based out of, and it's just a small town. We're west of Springfield. Not a lot, you know, happens here. We invented the traveling Ferris wheel here in Jacksonville. And there, you know, that's about it. I mean, there's not a lot that happens here, but there is this story about this guy. We have two colleges here in town, McMurray College and Illinois College. And there was a guy named Bruce Campbell, not to be confused with, you know, the actor Bruce Campbell, right. In 1959 came to town. His son was attending McMurray College. And he was a stockbroker, just an ordinary, normal, just an average guy. Not, you know, late 50s, traveled across the country from Massachusetts to visit his son. He and his wife drove here. And he got really tired, worn down by the drive. That was the only excuse for how he was feeling. This was in April, so it was springtime. And he wasn't feeling great. And they checked into what was then known as the Sandman Motel. It was a little place out on the north side of town. It's not there anymore. But after checking in, he visited with his son, and they got together with some friends who lived in the area. And everything was fine, except he seemed very tired. And when he went to bed that night, he really just don't feel good. I'm just going to try to get some sleep. I don't want to do anything else. You know, let's just, you know, sack out and call it a night. So she woke up at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and they were in, you know, it was the late 50s. They had two beds in the hotel room, and the other bed was empty. And his keys, his class ring, his wallet, everything was still sitting on the nightstand where it had been sitting, but he was gone. Door had been unlocked, and he, you know, apparently had gone outside. So she went out to look for him, didn't find him anywhere around. He didn't show up. She searched all around the area, around the hotel, but there was nothing, no one to be found. So she called the police, and the police chief, Ike Flynn, who's he's not alive anymore, unfortunately, but he did talk about this case every once in a while when he was older. But they came in. They brought in all kinds of police, Boy Scouts. A lot of the students from McMurray College came and volunteered to search. Farmers, everything. They searched the entire area, everywhere around the motel, all the way through town. It's not that big of a town. They searched the whole town. They searched the fields all around it. And he had simply walked out barefoot wearing a pair of green pajamas and was never seen again. And this is a small town. There's no reason that he would not have been found, especially in, you know, even if he had just walked straight north out into the farms or in the fields or anything, he would have, they would have found this guy, but he just literally disappeared. And whatever, you know, whatever happened to him, again, we don't know. I mean, the crime rate in Jacksonville in 1959 was like single digits. I mean, it's not like someone would have just kidnapped this guy. I mean, they didn't get anything from him. He had no money, had no wallet with him. He was wearing his pajamas. So even if he just had some kind of nervous breakdown or something, or slept walk or whatever, and just wandered out into the streets, he would have turned up somewhere, but he's just gone. And that's kind of like our local unsolved mystery here in town. But, and it's not exciting. There's no big dramatic thing behind it, but there's no possible reason this guy should have disappeared. That's
really bizarre. How about the you know, what's kind of fascinating to me now, Troy, is the use of Google Planet and Google Maps mm-hmm. and all this deal, that yeah. you can actually see these overhead views and that they're finding cars and
I know I've seen
place.
Some of those. Yeah. Yeah.
And there was one that just happened. I think we reported on it just a few years ago. They, in this overhead view of the lake, you could see the tops of two cars. These two cars went missing like the same day, 50 years apart.
Oh, I remember
and ended up
that.
Right next yeah. to one another. Yeah. And they found the remains of the people that had gone missing, one from the 50s and one from, I want to say, like the 90s or early 2000s. And yeah. that, boy, that's going to help solve a lot of unusual crimes as well, I think, once you realize just how many bodies are in lakes.
Well, this new technology, I mean, it's just like the, you know, people who send in their, 23andMe and, all that kind of ancestry DNA stuff. And then, I mean, that's, they're finding, murderers that way now by using other people's DNA. That's something that no detective would have dreamed of. Well, certainly not 100 years ago, but not even 30 or 40 years ago in most cases, when in the 90s, when DNA was new technology, and now we've gone beyond that into technology that takes advantage of technology. So we're several steps beyond it now. And it's crazy that's where we're at, with that kind of thing. Not that it's common, but it does happen.
Or if you're Dave Schrader, you send in your blood sample to Ancestry and you find a daughter you didn't know you had. And then 3 years later, a father and eight siblings, which is
boy.
Amazing. So
yeah,
the world is
crazy.
Happening to me. Yeah. But hopefully I don't shake free any criminals in my past.
Let's hope not. That's kind of what I was thinking, too, when I sent mine in. I thought, oh, great. I'll probably find out that, somebody was, killed 24 people or something. And I'll, be linked to that forever. Although right. really, in my line of work, it wouldn't be that bad. So no. as long as they were already dead and it was a long time ago. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. That's what I was afraid of is you spit in that cup, you send it in and it goes, hey, do you want to see who you're related to? I'm just like, please don't let it be Speck, Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer. Right. I'm wanting Lincoln. Hell, I'd even settle for Troy Taylor at this point, but don't let it be.
Just don't let it be. Yeah.
Adolf Hitler. No.
Right. Exactly.
all right. Well, getting back into some of the more unusual and bizarre crimes, what are some of the other ones that you decided to focus on for this book and mysterious disappearances?
Well, the one that's always fascinated me, and I don't even know if we call it super mysterious just because, under the situation where he disappeared. But Ambrose Bierce has always been one of those people that wrote so many cool stories about disappearances. And then, one day in 1910, he decides he's going to go out and go on an adventure and is never seen again. And of course, he went down to Mexico to see what was going on with the revolution. So you're asking for it, right. when you'd go do something like that. But what's cool about his whole story, though, when you put it together, is that he wrote several fictional stories about disappearances that people believed were real. For instance, the one that most people know is the story. It was called like the disappearance of Charles Ashmore, and it's been moved to different towns. And sometimes you'll find this turn up in a, strange but true book or true ghost stories or something about this boy that goes out to get water. It's in the winter and he goes down to the well to get water and he doesn't come back. And his family goes out to look for him and they find his footsteps leading to the well. And then they just suddenly, they're gone. They just disappear. He just vanished. And then, in the days or weeks that followed in the story, his mother or his sisters or her father or something will hear him calling for help in the distance, but he's nowhere around. And then his voice will become fainter and fainter and fainter. And eventually it just goes away altogether. And that's not a true story. Ambrose Bierce made that up, but somehow it's gotten into folklore and become a true story. And he wrote others too. He wrote about guys that go into a house in Kentucky and disappeared and then, were never seen again. And these stories just kept popping up in different places. Sometimes his name was Charles Ashmore, sometimes it was David Lang, but all of the stories were fictional accounts. except for one. He actually investigated a story that took place in 1854. He went to the place. He wasn't there. He wasn't when it happened, but it made the newspapers, and it was about a farmer in Alabama named Orion Williamson, who had been walking across a field one day and in front of several neighbors just disappeared. And they couldn't figure out where he'd gone, what had happened to him. They checked the field. They looked for mines. They looked for caves, anything they could to try to find this guy. And they never found him, but they heard his voice. They could hear his voice coming from the field. And eventually, the spot where he disappeared, all of the grass died. Now, that was actually a true story that Bierce had uncovered in his research and had gone to Alabama to talk to people who were still alive who'd seen it happen. And from that, he created all of these fictional stories. So that it's like, I don't know, it's like a real life gave birth to fiction, and then his life, which was real, is almost like a fictional story because he got old. He felt like he'd lived his greatest experiences in life during the Civil War. So in 1913 or so, he told his daughter he was going to tour all the battlefields that he had, that he'd been at during the war. And then he was going to go down to Mexico to, hang out with Pancho Villa. And apparently he did, because he sent her letters, and then he sent her a letter from Laredo, Texas, and told her that he was off on a great adventure, but he talked to her soon, and then he just vanished. And to this day, no one knows what happened to him. There were some who said that he, was killed by Pancho Villa because he, apparently irritated him. And if you know anything about Ambrose Bierce, he was like the original curmudgeon, and they nicknamed him Bitter Bierce because he was one of those guys that just loved to complain about everything, and he made a lot of people mad. And right. So they just assumed that he pissed off. Oh, sorry. I probably shouldn't have said that. They assumed he irritated Pancho Villa, who put a bullet in him, or he rode off to war with him and just never came back. But it's so ironic. And I think that's why the story appeals to me so much, is this is a guy who became famous writing stories, fictional stories about people who disappeared, based on a real story about someone who disappeared, who then in turn disappeared himself. I mean, you can't beat that.
No,
I mean, I'm going to say that Bierce probably wanted it that way. I mean, if you could plan it, wouldn't you want to go out that way? I mean, I'd love to be like a guy who's known for writing about mysterious disappearances, and then when I'm 95 years old, just never be seen again. How awesome would that be?
I can arrange to have something like that happen, Troy. I know a few people.
Right.
Do you want Blackwater or alligator? Your choice on how you're never found.
Right.
Yeah, that is wow. Yeah, that's like the perfect story. Speaking of, I don't know if you heard this recently, since we are on the kind of strange disappearances and weird deaths and such, and mysteries. Did you hear about the library? We just reported on this like a week ago, where Agatha Christie books are being held. Her books keep flying off the shelves.
I did hear about that.
And I don't mean they're selling quickly, folks. I mean, literally, the books are launching themselves off the shelves onto the floor. You've got this great mystery writer, and her books are seemingly, I don't know if there's a ghost or what is going on, but something is launching her books onto the floor.
Yeah, it makes no sense. I mean, it really doesn't. I mean,
well,
there's no easy explanation for it.
She vanished without a trace as well, didn't she?
Well, only for a few days. And there were some other things going on
I just remember that headline.
Involving her marriage. Her husband was having an affair, and so she, to get it back at him, decided that she was going to disappear mysteriously. And then they found her hiding out in a hotel somewhere. So her disappearance didn't last very long, but she did disappear.
You're one of the most famous writers in the world, and you're going to hang out in a hotel?
Right, I know, right? So I don't think she tried very hard. I think it was more for attention than anything else.
Yes, I think it was revenge. Please deliver some tea up to Christy Agatha's room.
Yeah. And no, I'm not the author. That's backward.
Right.
Yeah. Could you deliver that to Miss Marple's room, please?
Exactly.
You
know, yeah.
No one would ever suspect.
Never in a million years. The murders, and, you know, we've talked about Hoffa's murder, of course, over the years and the strange disappearance. And obviously there's been a few different versions of, you know, his bodies in the Giants stadium or, you know, as they are reporting it now that, you know, perhaps it was incinerated with the story and that documentary for The Irishman or the movie, mm-hmm. I should say, The Irishman. But there's been the book that it was based on, I Hear You Paint Houses. He documents pretty well that this is what happens. But people are fascinated by murder and mystery, and especially when it comes to just strange disappearances of well-known and not so well-known people. It just doesn't make any sense. But right. you know, in the day, you could say, I could see how a Jimmy Hoffa could maybe even vanish himself.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Get out. And there was all of that. But nowadays, I just don't understand how somebody could effectively remove themselves from the grid.
It's certainly a lot tougher now with, I mean, there's, you can start with, you've got to have a credit card anymore to go anywhere. You've got to have an ID. You've got to have Social Security. You can't fly anywhere without all the, you know, ID that you'd have to have. So you'd have to drive. But of course, your car is registered 42 different ways. Plus, you've got GPS in your car and your phone can be traced. I mean, it can be done, but I think it would be very difficult. But yet 90,000 people or so go missing every single year in the United States. And a good portion of those are never found. So, and yes, a lot of those could be murders, but there still have to be a lot of people who are just walking away from it all and just never coming back. I mean, well, it can be done, but it's a lot tougher than it used to be. So
if they're listening to this show right now, then I have an important piece of advice. If you are, and I mean this in all seriousness, some people are in very bad situations and they vanish because that's their only option, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
With the advent of social media, all of the pictures we've put online, if you pop up somewhere else and you're now Agatha Taylor and trying to hide out, and you've now put up your photograph as a totally different person, the algorithms and facial recognition will find you. How do I know this? Because people I haven't spoken to or seen in decades, I have one picture up of them from 2007. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it's like, hey, you might recognize.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And show me a picture of this person that's kind of fallen off the face of the earth. So you cannot really disappear in today's society, especially if you're continuing to utilize social media.
Well, that would be the thing right there. If you're going to disappear without a trace, you need to not start a new Facebook account, you know, so.
But
you
all
just
the
can't,
people aren't going to know what I'm eating today. Or see my dog pictures.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah. So, yeah, you'll want to avoid Facebook and everything else if you're going to disappear without a trace. But, you know, I was thinking we were talking about murders and people who never, you know, showed up and around areas where we grew up. Do you remember, and you would have been pretty young. I mean, I was, but I only vaguely remember it. Do you remember when Helen Brock disappeared in like 77? Oh, the candy heiress in Chicago? Yeah.
I do. I don't remember what happened, though.
Yeah. Well, she's never been found. To this day, she's never been found. But she, the wealthy, married the guy who owned Brock Candy and, you know, inherited all his money, but then got mixed up with, you know, horses and things, which, I mean, it was something that was a big thing at the time. And when you have a lot of money, horses and horse racing and all that stuff. But she met up with this guy, I think his name is Richard Bailey, and he was a con artist, like a womanizer gigolo type that would prey on older women. And he got mixed up with the horse people, which then in turn got her mixed up with Silas Jane, that guy that was involved in all the horse mafia, they called them in Chicago at the time. And, you know, she just disappeared one day and has never been seen since. And several people, you know, claim that they know that she was murdered because she was going to the authorities to complain about horses that she'd bought that turned out to be worthless and that kind of thing. And, you know, her boyfriend, who'd been mixed up with the horse dealer, swore that he didn't have anything to do with it. But he ended up going to jail, not for her murder, but for swindling and some other stuff. But even when he got out, he maintained his innocence. But what was interesting about that whole story is that eventually, while she was never found, her murder investigation ended up leading to the discovery of who killed the Schussler-Peterson boys in 1955 in Chicago. So it was a guy who worked for Silas Jane, the horse trader. I mean, it's a very complicated story, but it's one of those disappearances that was someone famous, you know, and we assume that she was murdered because, like Hoffa, you know, it was the people that she was involved with, but she's never been found either. And that would make a good movie, I think, if someone did something about her. And I don't know that anyone ever has, but I think it would be a good one. Probably is, you know, along the lines of, you know, The Irishman or something, or one of the other movies that have been made about Hoffa. But it's a cool story. You know.
Yeah, I knew a good author who was fascinated by that story with some time off that could write a screenplay about that.
Yeah, I'm kidding. I got some time off.
God. Well, this does give you more time to start focusing on more books, Troy.
Well,
so that can't be bad.
I hardly ever write anything anyway. So, but actually, I am finishing up right now some of the last editing that I had to do on my next book. So I am excited about that. So,
see, there you go.
Lots of
silver linings. Yeah,
yep.
Hopefully people will, during this time off, find the glory of books again and delve into your mysterious world and all of the great the books on true crime and supernatural that you're putting out there. Again, we have a link today on our program for Troy's website and for this book that we're discussing today. All right, let's get back to it. What are some of your other favorite stories that you represent in the book?
Well, a lot of the stories, you know, we're not laughing so much earlier, but we were talking about, you know, people who go off into the jungle and things and then just, you know, disappear and, you know, and you kind of go, well, you kind of ask for it. But the Michael Rockefeller story is one that has always fascinated me too, because here was a guy who, like Ambrose Bierce, went off to do something that he really wanted to do. And in his case, he wanted to go to New Guinea and take pictures of headhunters. You know, it's kind of like, I'm going to go join up with Pancho Villa and hope nothing bad happens. But the funny thing, I mean, the Rockefellers at the time in the 60s were one of the most powerful families in the United States, well, in the world, with the kind of money they had. And I guess it just goes to show that it doesn't matter how much money you have. If you disappear and, you know, fate or, you know, the elements or whatever are against you, it doesn't matter how rich you are, you're still gone. Because they did everything they could to search for him. You know, he'd gone off to make a documentary. That was his thing. And he was and take photographs and met with all of these tribes that, you know, had been, for the most part, uncontacted by modern life. But by all accounts, he was well-liked, got along with them, et cetera. But as far as we know, I mean, best speculation on this is that they ate him. Literally ate him because they were known for being cannibals. And some of the guys who were interviewed years later mentioned or told stories about cooking him on the beach. And it's just, I mean, it's not funny, but it's just like, you know, you kind of ask for it. But it's still such a fascinating story that, you know, here was a guy who was really in his element and he just vanished from it. You know, it was something that he knew how to do. He'd been there before, and it doesn't matter, you know, like I said, it doesn't matter how much money you have or how familiar you are with it. If it's your time, I guess it's your time. Because there are this edition of the book, I went into some newer stories too. And one of the stories that had been bothering me for like 20 years was about Amy Robechtel. She was a runner in the Wyoming area. And she, you know, used to go to run the same route every day. And one day just never came back. And it's, you know, they found like her to-do list and her keys in her car and she just vanished and she's never been found, no matter how hard they've looked and how hard they've searched. And again, there's been speculation, you know, she may have run into the serial killer that was operating in the area at the time, but like New Guinea in the 1960s, it was it's a pretty remote area. There's plenty of places where a body could be hidden. There are a lot of places to disappear to. But like Michael Rockefeller, Amy knew this area. I mean, she lived there. She was an outdoors woman, and this is what she did. And yet it doesn't seem to matter sometimes. I guess that's kind of been the theme of the book, is that if it can happen to these people, it can happen to you, because who knows why they disappeared. So if they did, why couldn't you? And that's scary. That's scary, you know.
It shows that there is no delineation line there, right? I mean, anybody is and can be a victim of these mysterious disappearances.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's just like getting an illness or an accident or whatever. You never know when it might happen. And something like a disappearance seems extreme. But once you start thinking about those numbers, like I said, I mean, it's like 90,000 people go missing all the time. And when you think about those kind of numbers, you think that your percentages just went up by quite a bit. And, you know, maybe you didn't want to disappear, or maybe you did, or maybe you just met the wrong person. I mean, it's impossible to know. It's impossible to predict. And I think that's one of the things that makes it so fascinating, but it's also the thing that really makes it really, really scary when you think about it.
What are your thoughts on these smiley face killer stories?
You know, it's interesting. I didn't know a whole lot about that until about maybe 10 years or so ago. And a friend of mine was telling me about it. And it's hard to. And I mean, now that there's been more publicity, you know, anybody could leave behind a smiley face and you know, could act like it was connected. But 10 years ago or so, when it wasn't highly publicized, and all of these murders and many of them, not all of them, but many of them very similar, a lot of drownings involved, young men involved, and then with these smiley faces left behind. I mean, that seems like a classic either serial killer story, or I mean, we could get really wild again with our speculations and say it was a group of people who were doing it, some sort of contest even. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I have learned that there's no limit to people's depravity. None whatsoever. And so it could be anything. People do this stuff for sport. They do it for fun. They kill people, they make people disappear, and they do it because they like it. And that in itself is terrifying as well. My next book that comes out that I'd been writing over the winter is about American cults and religions and homegrown religions, and the kind of stuff that I've written about over the last 6 months or so doesn't even compare to most of the true crime books I've written. And these are people who did these things in the name of religion or in the name of what they believed was their God. And when you're doing stuff like that, you realize that people have no limits. They'll do anything. They have no, there's just too many people have no conscience, you know. So it's hard to say, but I find that to be fascinating with this smiley face thing. And, you know, a lot of the experts are saying they're not connected. Some people say they are. I don't think we know yet. Maybe one of these days we'll have a clearer picture of it. But I think it would take someone to really do some investigation into it.
I can tell you. I mean, I grew up, I went to college at Winona State with mm-hmm. Tim. And, you know, it's a college town right along the Mississippi River where a lot of these kids have gone missing as well. And, you know, they're like, oh, this guy was a strong swimmer. He was an athlete. He was intelligent. He was this. I watched so many hyper intelligent athletes. And I know some people are rolling their eyes at that comment, but believe me, folks, there are intelligent athletes. But I watch some really hyper-intelligent people, and I know this. My son is an A scholar at Rose Holman Institute and is also an insanely good jock. But I've watched people make really dumb choices of, you know, hey, let's swim across to the other side to Bud's Beach. And you don't realize how strong I did that as a college guy. I swam from Bud's Beach across the Mississippi River during daylight, fully sober. And it was taxing and tiring. I can't imagine if you've had a beer or two and think you're going to just enter the water. It doesn't look that far. And you start swimming at night. when you're drunk thinking you're going to go over to Bud's Beach and meet up with some friends over there. So, you know, the people that are being affected, to me, sometimes I think you start seeing a bugaboo in every cabin, right? Sure. I think sometimes it's just you're in a college town. You're drinking, maybe imbibing in some recreational narcotics, and you think you're impervious. And that is the age, man. Tim and I could tell you, Tim's open about it, that you think you can mix weed and booze and stupid antics and get away with it. You know, I don't necessarily think there's some nefarious underground, but you know, with that said, I've talked to a few people that have been investigating this and have had some really chilling experiences and threats made to their life for getting
really
too close. Yeah.
Wow.
Steph Young, the author, was talking to us about this, and you know, there's much she said offline that she couldn't say on air with us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was really chilling. So, you know, you hope that that's misconstrued or misunderstood information.
Right.
But
right.
Some
or,
of the,
or,
some
you know, in a lot of cases, you might end up with three or four that are right. connected. Mm-hmm. And then everybody just keeps connecting everything else to it, too. I mean, we've seen that happen lots of times over the years with different cases. It you know, there's maybe only a handful that are for real or are connected, at least. And then you start pulling in clues from other ones and make them fit your theory. I mean, we've seen that happen a lot. So that could be part of it, too. You never know, you know.
The death ratio is bad. But again, when you just start to look at who's involved in this, you've got to start taking that cross section into examination. And I don't see a lot of people looking at the logical aspects of those disappearances and crimes as well. Mm-hmm. It's still heinous, it's horrendous. And let's face it, we'd rather point the finger at something outside than to think one may have just made a really poor choice.
Right. Right. That absolutely.
Moment. Yeah. What if you had to look at, I mean, you've written a lot, which story has been what you would think one of the most frightening of the true crime stories that you've ever reported on?
Gosh. Wow. Boy, that's a tough question because there've been so many. And, you know, I think that a lot of them that involve children are always the worst, you know, they're always the worst. And, but the one story I think that has bothered me more than anything, and maybe it's because I sympathize with the victims too much in this particular instance, but the story of the Grimes sisters, which is kind of a combination of a disappearance and then an unsolved murder too, I find to be so frightening because of, I guess, when it happened, where it happened, and the way that it's been left. I mean, these were two young girls, 12 and 15, who went to a movie one night in December of 1956 and then just never came home. They went to the movies. They were supposed to be home later that evening. They didn't show up. And then their bodies were found a little over 2 weeks later on the edge of a wooded road far away from their home. I mean, miles away from their home. They were naked and had been killed. And some people, I mean, to this day, we still don't know for sure how they died. They were, you know, had been beaten. They'd been stabbed, had been roughed up. But it's thought that they died of exposure, which means that when they were put on the side of the road, they froze to death. Some people say they've been raped. Some people said they weren't. There was so much confusion at the time. You had three different law enforcement agencies trampling all over everything because there was really no way to pick up clues or anything at the time. And, you know, it's just one of those stories where, you know, it was the 1950s, and it wasn't something that you expected to happen to two young girls. And they, you know, had their own history, some of which has been questioned, some hasn't. You know, they were said to have gone out to bars and all kinds of stuff. And then on the other hand, they had friends who said they were, you know, completely innocent and don't know how it happened, don't know who picked them up. I mean, nobody knows. I mean, to this day, no one knows where these girls were, why they were killed, what happened to them on the night they disappeared, and what happened to them for the 2 weeks, you know, before their bodies were found, because they weren't dead the entire time. So, that's remained a mystery. Who were the girls that people kept seeing during the time they were missing? Because they kept showing up, or at least according to reports, showing up in restaurants and bus stations and all kinds of places all over the Chicago area while they were supposed to be gone. I mean, thousands of people were questioned, thousands of people searched for them, and their bodies were just found on the side of the road. And, you know, that road got a reputation for being haunted for years. I think it's less so by ghosts than more haunted by memories of the thing of what happened there. But that story has always really creeped me out. It's always bothered me. I've always found it to be really, I don't know. It's a heartbreaking story. I mean, when you think about what happened to the family afterwards, just sort of fell apart, or parents died. And, you know, after the girls had their bodies had been found, and the case dragged on and on and on, and then ended up going cold and never being solved. And, you know, it's funny. I was working on a book about the case, and I always been fascinated with it, and I've been researching it for years. And one night, just probably, I don't know, maybe a couple of months before the book came out, I was at home, and I got a phone call really late, and it was my partner, Lisa's dad. And at the time, he wasn't in very good health, and in fact, he passed away just a few months after this. But he called me up to tell me that he said, "Hey, I've heard you've been working on this story about the Grimes sisters." And I said, "Yeah." And he knew the sheriff who had been involved in the case, Sheriff Lohman, who was the Cook County sheriff at the time. But Lisa's dad used to work for the state of Illinois, and he used to go up to Chicago on a regular basis. And sometimes when the sheriff needed to come down to Springfield, he would ride down with Lisa's dad. And so he told me a lot of stories that about the Grimes sisters. George, her father, was quite a bit older. And so he was around in the 50s when all this was going on. And I guess the sheriff gave him a lot of information that I was able to include in the book that I wasn't able to, you know, find anywhere else. And it's, you know, I guess it made it kind of personal because he knew, was involved in the situation. And, you know, even though for me it was a story that happened, you know, a little over a decade before I was even born. But there's just something about that story. It's baffling to this day. And I'm positive it's never going to be solved, which is too bad. But I just don't see how it ever could be at this point. I think it's just been too long. Too many people are gone. So, but that one's not in this book. But it is, you know, it's a combination of a lot of different things I write about. And so it's one that's always bothered me. So there you go. There's my scary story for me personally, anyway.
The missing, you said, what is it, 90,000 people a year go missing?
Yeah. And the percentage on that, I mean, I think it's even higher than that. I think maybe 90,000 are the ones who aren't found. I think the numbers may be even higher. I may be a little off on that. So, but that's how many people actually go missing. Now, a lot of those are found within a day or so, but the reports are, I believe, higher than that. I think the 90 is the ones who aren't found. So that gives you an idea. But of course, we're talking about a country of 329 million people. So I guess percentage wise, that's not that high, but that's an awful lot of people, in my opinion. But yeah, I think the 90s, how many aren't found. So that makes it worse, I think.
Terrifying. Now, your new book is on cults, you said. When do you expect to have that book out, available?
Actually, it should be out later in April. It's almost wrapped up as far as all the publication stuff goes. So
well,
it should be out very soon.
That's something that fascinates me. So let's make sure that we connect again.
Sure.
After the new book comes out. And we've got more with our guest, Troy Taylor, that'll be coming later on this week. As a matter of fact, on our Sunday show, folks, you're going to want to tune in and check it out. Troy Taylor will be back with us. A Song of Dance and Death, Magic, Murder, Mayhem, and the Diabolical Notes of the Devil's Music. We'll delve into that world of the paranormal when we return this weekend with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. Troy, thanks again, man. Congratulations on the book. I can't wait to see what the next one looks like when it comes out.
Great. Sounds great, man. We'll talk soon.
All right. Thank you very much, folks. Let's get ready now because we've got many files to examine. Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals next here on True Crime Tuesday.
It's Crayon News Storytime. What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
Well, it's always a pleasure catching up with Troy Taylor. Tim, I'm glad we were able to have him on for some True Crime Tuesday. He'll be back again with us as we dip more into the world of the strange and supernatural this weekend on Darkness Radio. And again, folks, we are here for you. We will continue providing you top-notch entertainment in the world of true crime and supernatural news. If there's one thing you can count on during this tumultuous times, it's your old pals, Tim and Dave. All right, Tim. One other thing that we can always count on in these tumultuous times?
Mm-hmm.
Dumbass criminals.
Oh, of course.
I love this one, though. Mm-hmm. This is a very cavalier deal. Here's a headline, Tim, from Louisiana. A driver pulled over with expired license plate tags. He says, sorry, officer, I've been busy since 1997, Tim. Now, you might be too busy to go to the grocery store, maybe to visit your parents, or even to eat a good, healthy breakfast, Tim.
Right, yeah.
But one Louisiana man, he told police he's just been too busy to renew his tags for almost 23 years, Tim. A Slidell Police Department officer pulled over a man for an expired license plate that hadn't been renewed since 1997.
Uh-huh.
When the officer asked the man why, the driver replied, sorry, officer, I've been busy lately and totally forgot to renew my vehicle registration. I'll take care of it as soon as I get home. Louisiana drivers are required to renew their tags every 2 years, Tim.
Oh, well, okay, so he really hasn't missed 23 years, Dave. He's
right.
Really only missed like 11 or 12.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess his crime is not nearly as heinous as it sounds, but boy, I've just been busy. I want to know how lazy the police are in Louisiana, Tim, because if my plates are 2 days expired, I get pulled over in Minnesota.
Oh, you aren't kidding.
I mean, it could be that, I kept mooning the cops as I drove by.
Well, you shouldn't.
And they find that
that
reckless driving, I guess.
Well,
and then they hit me for the expired tags on top of it, Tim.
Well, they don't actually call that reckless driving. They call it Denny's driving.
Denny's driving?
Yeah, oh. Denny's driving. It's moons over Miami.
Oh, I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're going to Flint Township, Michigan, Tim, where Flint Township police say that one man robbed the same Speedway gas station at knife point twice in a week. Well, it's like a slot machine, Tim. If it keeps paying off, why not just stay with it? Am I looking at this wrong, you think?
Well, no, but, I know if it keeps paying off, you keep going with it, but normally in Vegas. But, I don't think that's how robberies work.
No, that's not how it goes?
No.
Well, Dennis Horton is now facing two counts of armed robbery, Tim, and one count of unlawful imprisonment stemming from a February 23rd and March 1st robbery. Police say Horton walked into the Speedway on Corona Road, Tim.
Oh, no.
Ooh, Corona's just getting bad PR all the way around.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, he allegedly threatened the cashier with a knife before stealing cash and some smokes, Tim. Because if you're going to get caught and go to jail, you want to have some marketable, transactionable change. And trading for smokes is what you do in prison. At least that's what I found from all my 1930s gangster movies I watch.
Oh, I was thinking if you got away with a robbery, you're going to need a little something to get you, get the stress level down. But you're going with commerce. That's a good angle.
Well, that would be my deal. Mm-hmm. I would go with commerce. I'd be the Morgan Freeman of the prison cell, Tim. I'd be getting you your rock hammer. Uh-huh. And posters of Jacqueline Smith or whoever he had hanging up in his cell.
Jacqueline
Smith. Can't remember who that was. That's who I had. That was my first female poster, Tim, was Jacqueline Smith.
You didn't go the Farrah Fawcett route, huh?
I didn't. I wasn't a fan of Farrah Fawcett, to be honest with you. I thought she was a pretty girl. Don't get me wrong, but Jacqueline Smith. Wow,
I was a Linda Carter guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. Linda Carter. Yeah. Very attractive. By the way, we just lost Lyle Wagner, who played Steve Trevor
I was wondering why Spider Baby had posted the picture of Lyle Wagner. I hadn't heard he died.
Yeah. Lyle Wagner from the Carol Burnett Show. Did you know he was originally up for the role of Batman in the famous TV show?
Really?
Yeah, he and Adam West, those were the two final people. And as a matter of fact, you can find online for you Batman aficionados and fans, if you don't already know this, you can go on and see Lyle Wagner's screen test with a different Robin as well. And then they'll show you his screen test with his Robin and Adam West and Burt Ward, and you'll understand why Adam and Burt got the job. Well, investigators believe Horton returned to the same speedway at about 3:35 a.m. on March 1st. He again is accused of threatening the clerk with a knife for stealing cash. Detectives say evidence led them to Horton as a possible suspect. Police arrested and interviewed him before transporting him to the Genesee County Jail. Horton was arraigned on the armed robbery and imprisonment charges. He remains in custody at the jail awaiting further court proceedings. Genesee County. Is that, where is that? No, it is Michigan. I was right. Yeah, Flint, Michigan area. That's where this story came to us from. Here's a case of swift justice, Tim. Swift justice, swift justice, swift justice.
Ooh, that one put my C2 out.
Did it?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. California homeowner uses motion-activated sprinklers with impressive amount of pressure in order to thwart some thieves, Tim. Thief thwarting.
Ooh.
With some water.
Easy. Easy there, Sylvester.
Thief thwarting with water. It's despicable. A homeowner in California is trying to flush out crime, Tim. The Porterville resident recently decided to deter potential thieves in her neighborhood by setting up a motion-activated sprinkler. Our floodlight didn't seem to scare them off, so we decided to have a little fun with a motion-activated sprinkler that has an impressive amount of pressure. That's what Katie Camarina wrote on her Facebook, Tim. Hey, Katie Camarina.
Hi.
According to Camarina, there have been recent issues with thieves coming into the neighborhood to try and steal tools out of vehicles, in addition to anything else they can get their hands on. In the video that she posted to Facebook, someone on a bicycle who came to her home on Tuesday can be seen getting hit with a powerful jet of water after setting the sprinkler off. The person on the Ring video then ducks away and pedals off.
I'd pay money to sit in that window and watch that all day long.
Oh, yeah. Would that not be great? Yeah, some jackass trying to steal from you. No, some just pins you to the side of the truck.
Or even just somebody riding by on a bike and getting hit by a spray.
Yeah. So she's got it in the bed of her pickup truck.
Mm-hmm.
So she's got the sprinkler. You can see the hose running up the back, and the guy on a bike comes riding up and is going to get something, and that sprinkler sees him and bap, 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 bap. People are creative in these times of crisis, Tim. I'll give them that.
You gotta love it.
Yeah. Here's kind of a turn on a story, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
How many times have we reported on fast food frenzies where somebody goes in and can't get the food or perhaps even the condiments they want, and they kind of explode into craziness?
Oh, quite often, although it's going to be a little harder with a lot of states shutting down in-store dining, but, you know.
Well, DeKalb County, Georgia has a story turning that on its ear. An employee at a local fast food restaurant shot a customer that was complaining about their wings order, Tim.
Oh.
The shooting happened. I'm not laughing at the shooting.
No,
I'm just this is old West shit going on here, Tim.
Yeah, it is.
Hey, barkeep, that ain't a full shot of whiskey. You calling me a liar, boy, that's some wild West shit going on.
You want
on
a
right
full
there.
Shot. Here's a full shot.
Yeah, bam, that's it. The shooting happened after midnight. Oh, there's going to be liquor involved, Tim, at the Checkers off Candler Road in DeKalb County. The manager confirmed the shooting to Channel 2's Kristen Holloway. WSB, the spook, Tim, is reporting the story. Police identified the ex-employee as a 24-year-old named Jonte Robinson. DeKalb County Police said the victim in his early 30s was shot in the upper body, taken to the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. Robinson was arrested and charged with aggravated assault. The manager told Holloway the shooting started over a chicken wing order, as it often does, Tim. Two men placed their order at the walk-up window. That's when they became upset when the order was wrong, according to the manager. She said they tried to remake the order when the two men started yelling at employees. So far, I'm not seeing an actionable motion to shoot somebody, so we'll see where it goes from here.
Yeah.
The manager said after they opened the window back up, one of the men threw all the wings at the employee. All right. That is frustrating and aggravating. Right? Maybe assault with a flavorful weapon. I don't know. But this is when Robinson just shot the customer. Enough is enough, God damn it! Bam! And that was it. Holloway spotted several bullet holes in the shattered window and the wings that started it all still sitting on the counter, Tim.
Wow.
That might be overkill. That's you know, I'm all for the, you know, protect yourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But seriously, what the deuce? Okay, we're in a scary, uncertain time, Tim. This coronavirus.
Right.
Pushing across the planet.
Yeah.
Some people are not dealing with it well.
Like that.
And here's a brand new story coming to us. Person under coronavirus lockdown in Spain attempts to leave the house cleverly disguised as a T-Rex, Tim. not going to stand out at all. The Spanish police have urged citizens to remain indoors during the COVID-19 state of emergency after encountering one citizen on the street dressed as a dinosaur. Video of the incident was posted to Twitter yesterday by the police department showing an unidentified citizen being stopped by a unit of officers who were attempting to enforce the government's plan to limit the spread of the disease caused by a novel coronavirus that is now spreading globally. On Friday, Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez imposed a 15-day state of alarm that restricted free movement apart from traveling to work, food, health, medication, or for caregiving. One small exception was that pets can be taken out on short walks, but police noted on social media that dinosaurs are not considered to be included in this category. Your Honor, I say Your Honor! Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law, checking in on this crime, sir. I want you to know that my client identifies as a T-Rex and identifies as his own pet T-Rex. And Your Honor, in this day and age, how dare you deny my client the ability to identify as a T-Rex? It's this close-mindedness, Lord, that brings people to shooting angry customers over misserviced wings, Your Honor. So I just ask, Lord, that we throw it. Lord, your lordship.
Lord,
I don't know.
Geez.
What do we call Spain, Tim? Are they lordships? Are they your honor? Are they jefe? I don't know.
Jefe.
I don't know. I don't know the terminology used. I don't want to upset the Spanish
jefe,
courts.
We're not in Mexico. No, I just think it's your honor. Yeah. You still,
your honor. Your lordship.
It's not.
Lord and.
Your lordship would be a royal title. I don't think you would go there. Yeah.
I'm sweetening the pot, Tim. I'm trying to get this man out.
I understand. The fact that you started out with a southern accent, I thought we were in the south of Spain.
There's a southern part of every country, Tim.
That's
and
right.
I am from southern Spain when representing.
Right.
During the state of alarm, walking of pets is allowed if accompanied by one person, always short walks, so they can relieve themselves. Having a Tyrannosaurus Rex is not covered. Hashtag stay at home. That's what the police wrote on Twitter alongside with the footage, which has since attracted tens of thousands of shares and likes. The clip, which was edited to include the theme tune to the film franchise Jurassic Park, proved to be one small lighthearted moment during a challenging time for the country's authorities. Well, I don't think that's so funny, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, you're infringing on trademark music by one John Williams, Your Honor. And I will represent John Williams in this court of law if you do not remove said music and free my client. He was taking himself for a walk, and he was in a self-contained breathing apparatus known as the T-Rex inflatable costume, Your Honor. The only person he was infecting was himself.
medical
case dismissed.
Medical breathing device known as an inflatable T-Rex costume.
It's got a fan in it. It's recycling your own air.
Ah.
So I own an inflatable Godzilla costume.
Yeah.
Just to put this forward, don't fart in an inflatable costume.
Oh, good Lord.
I'm not saying that from personal experience, per se, Tim.
Right.
This comes from a good friend, but don't do it.
Okay.
Because you just breathe that recycled air.
Woo.
So.
Yeah. Creating your own coronavirus, I see. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Sanchez's wife, Vigona Gomez, has previously confirmed to have contracted the illness. The newspaper El País reported. I'm probably saying that wrong. It's probably like something very regal in Spain, and I just said the piss or something because I don't know how to put the right inflection on the wrong syllables.
The piss.
Law enforcement did not provide further details of why the citizen in the dinosaur outfit had been roaming the streets during the state of emergency, but a second video published to Twitter indicated that it may have actually been an attempt at a preventative measure. In that footage, a person in the same dinosaur outfit can be seen shuffling slowly along the sidewalk with a bag of rubbish in his hand before hurling it in a large waste bin and running back down the street. Your Honor, this case needs to be dismissed. See, it's even better than I thought, Tim.
Yeah.
It wasn't just taking. He took himself for a walk, picked up his own excrement, and was putting it in a trash receptacle.
Oh,
he
not.
Is a responsible pet owner of himself.
He's a responsible T-Rex, yeah.
He is his own, what are those animals at the airport that you see with their orange vests, Tim? What do they call that? The words escape me right now.
Flight attendant?
No, wow. What?
What?
Sure, take that back. No, the animals, your comfort animals. I can't think of what it's called.
A support pet or a support animal.
Yes, or comfort care animal, support animal.
Yeah,
he's just his own support animal as a T-Rex, Tim.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Wow, flight attendant, please just direct all your email right to Tim, the dickhead at darknessradio.com.
I prefer when I'm going through a tough time to have a flight attendant on my lap. I mean, it's the Ric Flair way, right?
Perhaps try the Tim at darknessradio email. Well, Tim, since we're talking about comfort animals, we're going to go to Miami, where a cow is on the loose. But not only just a cow, Tim, but a cow that's wanted by police in Pembroke Pines.
Oh, my.
Perhaps he's wanted for a moving violation, Tim.
Oh, no.
See what I did there?
No,
moving violation? Yeah.
Yeah.
Just saying. A cow's on the loose in South Florida. Not considered dangerous. But police have been trying to corral it now for weeks. The Pembroke Pines Police Department said Wednesday the animal has been spotted near Interstate 75 in southern Broward County. Somehow it has eluded capture since late January. The police department put out a tweet, wanted unknown cow. Got a warning out there, Tim. I just want you to think about this, Tim. In that same area, since the time that this has taken place, 12 have gone missing.
Really?
Man-eating cow? Huh? Just saying, Tim. Putting it out there. Police spokesperson Amanda Conwell said officers and wranglers have been unable to catch the animal. It jumps fences. It goes into pools to avoid the police. And the police just, they don't know what to do when a cow enters a pool, Tim. They just throw their hands up in desperation and they leave, I guess. Yeah. Police also say the cow is guilty of moving violations and utterly, Tim, despicable acts of fleeing and eluding police.
You didn't just do that.
I did. It's in the article, Tim, that part.
Okay.
The Associated Press is to be blamed for those two.
Okay.
We're going to wrap up with a cheery story, Tim. A lot of people in the hospital, a lot of people having a bad time.
Yeah.
Dad, one of them. Right?
Yes.
Here's a story. Maybe this would have been a case of swift justice if they had approached your dad in the hospital, Tim.
Okay.
A Florida hospital worker has been arrested. Franz Belladrin was arrested earlier this week for allegedly sucking patients' toes while he's on the clock. I wonder if it's okay if he does it off the clock, Tim. Hey, what you do on your own time, we don't care about. But you're not sucking toes when you're on the clock, pal.
I believe they call that a candy striper's duty, Dave.
He was on the clock at the Gulf Coast Hospital in Fort Myers. The shocked patient told police they felt their right foot being touched at around 11 p.m. They assumed a nurse was checking for swelling, but then they felt their foot being touched again and then again and again, feeling something between their toes, Tim. After the third time, the patient looked up only to find Belderin on his knees with his head bent over their foot. He was given some good toe there, Tim.
You.
The patient yanked their foot away after a few more moments and retreated back to his seat in the room where he was working as a sitter for the patient's roommate who had been deemed a flight risk. Oh, so this is a criminal. They were afraid this person was going to make a break for it. Maybe he's just, maybe this guy, Your Honor. I would like to have the good court consider this. Perhaps my client, Mr. Belderin, is extremely good at tasting exactly where a person has been or may be going.
Tasting where they've been?
Therefore, in case this flight risk takes off, Your Honor, he would have the best knowledge of where that dirt on the bottom of the feet came from originally, so that therefore you could find said flight risk, Your Honor. Ugh, gross, so disgusting.
He would be my luck. You know, I've got severe neuropathy in both my feet. He'd just be going to town. I wouldn't feel a thing. I'd be watching Matlock.
Are you saying that like you'd be upset that at least you're not even enjoying good toe?
Right, exactly. Yeah, just sitting back, not even knowing.
Yeah. Security was called. He was arrested on charges of battery on a person 65 years of age. Is that really battery?
It's more like liquory, isn't it?
Yeah, liquory is right. Yeah. He's being held in jail on $1,500 bond. For sucking toes, Tim. That's what it's going to get you in Florida. So if you got $1,500 in your pocket and you're willing to go a little radical, then that's the crime for you. But I wouldn't suggest it. It's gross.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I would have done if I caught him, Tim?
What's that?
I'd have given him a sock to the nose. A sock to the nose. You see what I did there, Tim? A sock, a foot, suck in the toe, yeah. A sock to the nose.
Yep.
Oh, God.
Yeah. You kill hey, you, folks. That's for sure. Yeah.
I do. Yeah. I entertain the living shit out of myself. Thank you, folks, for tuning in today. And we hope that you've been entertained by our strange tales of true crime and dumb crime, stupid criminals. We'll be back again next Tuesday with more of the best in True Crime Talk Radio. This weekend with more of the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. Darkness Radio continues our reign as the ever-present best in Paranormal Talk Radio. You can check out our website, Darkness Radio, for more information. Remember to order Troy Taylor's book. You got time on your hands. Read a book. Spend some time with your family, folks. I do want to put this out. I'm going to mention this again this weekend, but for those of you listening to our true crime program, this is an interesting point in history. Never before have we been closer as a civilization through the communication skills of our social media networks, our phones and computers, but never have we been further away from those that mean the most to us, our family and friends. Let's look at this as a cultural reset. Put down your phones, find times to be present with your family, friends, or whoever you're locked in with. Communicate with them. Tell stories. For the elderly, share your stories with the young. For the young, share your humor with the old, and just be a family again. That's what I hope for each and every one of you listening on today's program. Life is short. Make the very best of the time that you have now. And instead of looking at this as a tragedy, look at it as a way to find your family again and reconnect with one another. We'll be back again with more of the best in True Crime Talk Radio next Tuesday. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. This is True Crime Tuesday.